This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Just a reminder before we start, please subscribe and review our show on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners discover the show. Frankly, it makes us feel pretty good. All right, here's the show.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, I am coming to you from New York City, the United Nations General Assembly Week, and we had quite a debut for the new president of the United States. I mean, I guess he's not that new, but first time here at the United Nations. What a speech.
Elton John reference all included. Yeah, that's something. Look, I think you saw President Trump explain what it means to make America great again, and that means reconceiving of how America thinks of its role in the world. So I think it was a new day for President Trump.
Okay, and we've got a lot to talk about. I want to get into that a bit. We want to go through some highlights, including some undercovered highlights of that 42-minute speech, but also a lot of political drama coming out of the state of Alabama this week. We've got a rally coming up tomorrow with Sarah Palin and Sebastian Gorka supporting Judge Moore down in that Senate primary race. And then the next day, we'll see the president of the United States, Donald Trump, in Alabama campaigning for the other Republican in that primary runoff, Luther Strange. And we've got one last effort to try to get repeal and replace of Obamacare over the line. I want to hear your opinion, Rick, about whether or not that's going to pass.
We'll do some predictions.
We'll do some predictions at the end of the show. We're going to be hearing from a friend of the podcast, Chris Van Hollen, the chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and somebody who I think is probably looking really, really with interest at that Alabama, deep red Alabama primary. So we're going to be talking to Chris Van Hollen, but we got to start with this speech. I mean, first of all, Rick, I've got to tell you, I didn't know what to expect because we really never know what to expect with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But when he came out into that hall, this is somebody who had basically declared last year that the United Nations is an adversary to America. As harsh a critic as we have ever seen land in the White House of the United Nations. And when I saw him come into that hall, first of all, he seemed remarkably comfortable behind that, you know, in front of that green marble that he had ridiculed
that
years
he hates,
ago as
yeah.
being cheap. He seemed remarkably comfortable in the role. And for the first 15 minutes or so of that speech, he was substantive, he was serious, he was rather optimistic, he was talking about international cooperation, he was thanking our allies. And, you know, there was a time where I was wondering who I had tuned in to watch. And then North Korea came up.
And then North Korea. I think if you take out some of the Trumpisms, and I think you can put the Rocket Man line as part of that, it was actually a pretty conventional Republican speech to the United Nations. There was a lot in there that George W. Bush would say. Mitt Romney came out and said it was a great speech. Mitt Romney said it was a great speech. Now, he wouldn't have delivered it quite like Trump. But I think this was a guy that a lot of people thought was an isolationist. He was very critical of foreign policy adventurism under Democrats and Republicans. And he came out with a pretty robust vision of where you'd potentially use a military force. He called out a whole bunch of rogue nations, the Iranians and the Syrians and the North Koreans and the Cubans, the Venezuelans. And he challenged the United Nations to kind of get on board the sentiment that isn't just an American sentiment right now, but is an international sentiment that working together for common ideals. It wasn't as radical as you might think.
Yeah. And you know, he did say sovereignty a lot, which is a word you don't normally hear a U.S. president say at the United Nations. I think the count was 21 or so times. And what's interesting, Rick, I've been covering Donald Trump since you were in junior high school. Mm. And I don't think I've ever heard the guy say sovereignty before, but there it was 21 times talking about American sovereignty. And he didn't shy away from his America First theme that he has hit over and over again, but he did put an interesting twist on it. Listen to this.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
Okay. Okay. So, Rick, that was... You heard applause there, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. It's almost like they didn't know what to do.
And I want to be clear about something. For the vast majority of the speeches that are given there, there is no applause. I mean, there's occasionally some of that. But this is a very serious forum, a vast, cavernous hall. There's 189 or so delegations, you know, sitting there. You know, the ambassadors or leaders, note takers. But you don't hear people applaud very often. So that was the one applause line. And there I would take a little issue with you saying this seems like a rather conventional Republican president before the United Nations. I don't know. You know, traditionally you go and you talk about international cooperation and coming together and doing stuff in concert. It was fascinating to hear him come out with the America first, which might have rubbed some of those folks the wrong way. But they say, but I understand you guys are your countries first. And then within that, we can find a way to do things that are mutually beneficial. It was actually, I thought it was actually quite genius.
And is the view from the White House, John, that this is something the president has given a lot of thought to? Or is this a imposition of people around him, maybe Steve Miller among them, maybe some echoes of Bannon in that, of a foreign policy for a guy that's basically been a blank slate?
Well, did George Washington write the farewell address?
Sounds like a rhetorical question.
It was Alexander Hamilton, right? But George Washington decided that, that was the direction he wanted to go. Look, some of the language, that's why I refer to sovereignty. I mean, some of this did seem like something that, you know, he was reading something that didn't sound a lot like Donald Trump. But then, you know, you get to the section on North Korea, and I know there's been a lot of discussion of, you know, not just the Rocket Man thing, and that's fine, but the amazing threat that was made. Now, it's a conditional threat if we are forced to defend ourselves or our allies. But the idea of completely destroying an entire nation state, that is not something you normally hear somebody say. So before we get into that, because words matter, let's listen to exactly what he said in the full context, not just the short little, you know, Rocket Man soundbite. Let's listen to the whole section.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for. Let's see how they do.
Okay, so first of all, like I said, that really kind of, I jumped out of my chair when I heard him say totally destroy North Korea.
But, right, because it's not just end the regime or destroy the leadership.
Or regime change.
Destroy the country. Yes.
So, but before we get into that, I can say that I covered the Bush administration dealing with North Korea as a foreign affairs correspondent for ABC News, and I certainly covered the Obama administration dealing with North Korea. These were two vastly different approaches in some ways to foreign policy, but administrations that were filled with some of the most experienced and respected foreign policy hands of our time. You know, the Colin Powells and the Condoleezza Rices and the Hillary Clintons. And neither got North Korea right and have led us to where we are now. Now, this is a rather different approach. But I and Chris Van Hollen is about to join us. I want to ask him about this. But I spoke over the weekend with a very senior member of the Obama foreign policy team that said, one of the central problems that we have with North Korea is that the North Korean regime has been able to calculate and determine that the United States truly has no military option. And that is the conventional wisdom. And that is certainly the lesson that the North Koreans have taken. And therefore, they can move with all deliberateness on their missile program and on their nuclear programming, knowing that there really isn't anything we can do. We can go and try to do sanctions. How much more can you do in terms of sanctions on North Korea? But there really isn't a military option. So this top foreign policy national security official, former for the Obama administration, said something needs to be done to erase that perception. And this individual, widely respected, wasn't so dismissive of the approach that Donald Trump has taken. With that, and so much to talk about on the political front, good friend of our podcast, Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, the chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, joins us now. Senator Van Hollen, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you guys.
So we like a lot to get to on politics, but first I wanted to get your sense on the speech, particularly on that the rhetoric, the incredible threat leveled by the president there at the General Assembly towards North Korea.
So two things on that. First, I don't think that the name calling and the overblown rhetoric directed personally at the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, is useful at all. I think it actually serves to elevate the North Korean dictator and diminishes the United States. I do believe that President Trump should follow Teddy Roosevelt's good advice, which is speak softly but carry a big stick. On the second issue, the United States has long said that if North Korea takes any kind of military action, the United States will respond with overwhelming force. So to the point you were making, I don't have concerns about that, so long as it's clear that the United States would be initiating that force as a defensive measure. I do think we still have a lot of room in terms of tightening the sanctions. I mean, the UN has now passed several pieces of sanctions legislation. The sanctions noose is really just beginning to tighten, and I do think the Trump administration should support bipartisan legislation that I've introduced with Senator Toomey from Pennsylvania that would essentially proposes an Iran sanctions type regime, secondary sanctions regime, but directed at North Korea. And the prime target there would be Chinese banks and financial firms that continue to be used as conduits for financial dealings with North Korea. And until we get really serious about letting those Chinese banks and firms know that if they do business with North Korea, they don't have access to our markets, we're never going to have effective sanctions.
So what is there a red line on the North Korean program, the nuclear program and the missile program? I mean, at what point, or do you believe there is a point where they have perfected their missile technology or improved it to the point where they can actually reach mainland of the United States, where they can marry a nuclear device to a missile? Or is it they've been able to advance their nuclear program itself, that they could, you know, put a nuclear device in a container ship and, you know, send it into Long Beach? Is there a point where you say that it's not that defending ourselves isn't really defending ourselves against an attack, but the ability of that country to attack us with devastating force?
Well, it's very risky to draw really clear red lines. Obviously, an attack by North Korea on the United States or allies is an obvious red line, sure. And we should make it clear we will respond with overwhelming force. But we also do have the escalating threat with the development of their ICBM capability, as well as their nuclear weapons capability, and trying to marry up the two, the nuclear warheads to the missiles. And so I think that, as you said at the beginning, the risk of any kind of preventative war, so taking action not as a defensive measure, but in a preventative fashion, does put at risk the 25,000 Americans in South Korea, but also millions of South Koreans and our Japanese allies and others. That does not mean that the administration should not continue to say that we will look at all options, right? I mean, there may be options out there. I don't know. But I do think drawing a clear red line is dangerous in the sense that it really hems you in. And the other risk, of course, is U.S. credibility if you draw a clear red line and then do not act. So this is obviously an incredibly difficult issue. I mean, North Korea, as you indicated, has obviously continued to develop nuclear weapons over many administrations, Democratic administrations and Republican administrations, and now they're, you know, perfecting their technologies. And so I don't think the overblown rhetoric is at all helpful. I do think additional sanctions backed with the secondary sanctions regime that I talked about would be very useful. And then we need to work in concert with our allies. But making it clear that we will respond to overwhelming force to an attack by North Korea, I don't have a problem with that.
Senator, I want to ask about the big domestic issue right now, and that is the revival of the healthcare push. And you've been calling it a zombie bill and kill the zombies. And but I want to ask you from a policy perspective, also a political perspective, because clearly the Democrats are going to be against this. It's just whether they get enough Republicans, whether they can get to that magic 50 before September 30th. What, to your mind, is the political fallout here? What's the Democratic messaging going to be if Graham Cassidy passes here under the wire and the repeal and replace push actually gets results?
Well, I think you've already seen a lot of political fallout, even without this having taken effect. So, for example, in Nevada, Senator Dean Heller has come under all sorts of fire, in this case from all sides, for his positions on the health care issue. And I think you're going to see that in other Senate and House races, even if they didn't take the next step. If they actually were to take the next step and implement this latest version of Trump Care, the Graham Cassidy bill, I think it's going to be it's the wrong thing to do for the country. It's going to totally screw up our health care system. And I think people in all the states will begin to really feel the negative impacts right away. So I really hope they don't proceed. If they do, I think they will not only hurt lots of Americans, but I think, you know, politically, they're going to have to be held accountable.
Do you plan to support the single-payer bill that was filed last week by Senator Sanders? I know you said you'd take a look at it. And do you feel like that is something that Democrats should coalesce around to say, look, this is the vision that we have to offer as an alternative? It is a clear, crisp, bold vision. This is what we're behind.
So I welcome lots of ideas that are going to be presented as to how we further improve our healthcare system. We all know that the Affordable Care Act expanded access to affordable care for tens of millions of Americans, but we also know we have a lot of work still to do to bring down costs and premiums in our healthcare system and get to the goal of universal coverage. So I salute Senator Sanders for putting one idea on the table for getting to universal coverage. I think there are going to be other proposals. There are obviously issues of cost that need to be addressed. So I welcome the debate. I do think our focus right now, and I think Senator Sanders has made this clear, is to, you know, prevent President Trump and the Republicans from blowing up the Affordable Care Act and taking us backwards. And then we should have this debate about how we move forward in 2018 and beyond.
So I want to switch to this rather extraordinary Republican primary that I'm sure you're watching with some sense of glee down in Alabama, with Judge Roy Moore, who was twice elected to the Supreme Court down there and twice thrown off. Of course, Luther Strange, appointed by a very unpopular governor to fill out Jeff Sessions' term. And they are locked in this battle. Donald Trump is going down to campaign for Strange. Sarah Palin is going down to campaign for Roy Moore. Tell me about your candidate. This is about as deep a red a state as you can get. Tell me about your candidate down there. Do you see an opportunity for Democrats to actually play down in Alabama?
Well, we have a terrific candidate, a former U.S. attorney, Doug Jones, who brought the successful case prosecuting the KKK for the 16th Street bombing in Birmingham, where you had four little girls who were killed. And he is somebody who is, you know, connected to Alabama. And as you indicated, you've got Republicans who are firing at one another. They did in the earlier round one with Mo Brooks, Congressman Mo Brooks, when he was still in the race. He, of course, is endorsed, I believe, Roy Moore. And so you have a full-blown sort of Republican civil political war going on there. This is a special election. As you know, the date is on December 12th. And so we believe Doug Jones is connecting very well to people from all different political persuasions in Alabama. They do not want a senator who cannot deliver for Alabama on the issues. And they don't want somebody who's considered so out there and so extreme that, they cannot be effective.
Are you going to be competing in Alabama? Are you going to be spending money? Are you going to be spending in Alabama?
Well, I've already given a very sizable contribution, and I will continue to be supporting him. We are encouraging all of our members to strongly support Doug Jones, and we'll be looking at all our options in Alabama because this is a special election, and as we all know, turnout is everything in a special election. And I think Doug Jones is going to energize a lot of voters to come out. And I'm not sure after a bitter Republican primary whether that will be the case on the Republican side.
Do you reassess based on who wins? I mean, if Roy Moore wins, as John mentioned, this is a guy that has been a very polarizing figure in Alabama. Do you say, okay, now we've got more of an opportunity here than going against the incumbent senator in Luther Strange?
Well, I think, I mean, Luther Strange has had a lot of powerful negatives thrown at him by Roy Moore. I mean, Roy Moore has run lots of, has really hit him hard on a whole lot of issues. And so, you know, regardless of the outcome in the Republican race, we have a very strong candidate. We all know it's Alabama. That's been tough territory for Democrats, and no one's kidding themselves about how tough politically Alabama has been. On the other hand, we have a terrific candidate who's connected to people in Alabama, and Republicans have just gone through months of beating the hell out of each other.
Yeah, I mean, this is this map. Rick and I were talking before the show. You took this job as the chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Did you get a chance to look at the map before you?
They fool you? Did they trick you?
Are you suggesting I need to have my head checked? You see, the good news is I know that everybody who follows politics closely, like you guys, knows how tough it is.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, we've
so
got
we're counting on the people who know how tough it is. But listen, I mean, as tough a map as we have, and you know, for those who haven't followed this, we have 1/3 of the senators up, 33 senators up, and 25 are members of the Democratic caucus. And, 10 of those members are from states that Donald Trump won versus only one Republican senator is up from a state that Hillary Clinton carried. So, yes, it is a very tough map. That being said, we are seeing Democrats energized more than ever before, and our challenge is to translate that energy into people showing up at the polls. And increasingly, we see independents and moderate Republicans just fed up with the direction that both the Trump administration and this Republican Congress have taken. And so we also believe, in addition to our incumbent members being able to hold their ground, we believe we have some pickup opportunities as well. So Obviously, given the map, we've got a lot of defense and holding to do, but we also have some opportunities out there.
In that context, but in the interest of getting Democrats engaged in this, do you shudder just a little bit when you see Chuck and Nancy at the White House and talk about deals beyond the spending deal, maybe a deal on immigration to put stock on the table, there's some blowback there? Do you feel like Democrats are, you know, well served right now in pursuing any kind of deals with President Trump?
Well, if we put an idea forward that's a idea rooted in Democratic values and the Democratic position, and, you know, Donald Trump says yes, I think we take it. I mean, if we can make sure we make get the Dreamers law enacted and provide permanency, that's a good thing. On other issues, we've put forward really clear principles about what we need to see happen in order to get Democratic support. So, for example, on tax reform, we've been really clear tax reform cannot just be some Trojan horse for tax cuts for the rich. We laid out principles, no net tax breaks for the top 1%. It needs to be there to help middle-income Americans. We can't blow up the deficit. We got to go through the regular order. So long as we define our principles clearly, which we have, then if President Trump wants to support that proposal, which we believe would help Americans, we would do that. I will also say that our senators have been very clear that where, you know, the Trump administration is pursuing policies that hurt their states, they will fight them tooth and nail. But if it's a proposal that they've put forward or others have put forward that will help their states, they'll work to make sure that the people of their states get the best deal.
All right, Senator Chris Van Hollen, thank you for joining us. Before you go, just give us your prediction. Where are you going to, you look, we know where the map is. Republicans have a 2-seat majority right now. What will the Republican majority look like after the next midterms? Or do you think Democrats could somehow play to that inside straight and retake the Senate?
All right, guys. Listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to fight like hell to hold the blue wall in the United States Senate. And people are recognizing more and more how important that is because, you know, Trump keeps tweeting about how they need to change the rules around here. And so I think people have an even better understanding of how important it is to at least hold our wall. And then we will look for those additional opportunities to, as you say, draw to an inside straight. We have opportunities that are out there. We have some good candidates already running. We're going to have more candidates announcing in these challenger races. So we're just going to fight like hell.
These campaigns, Trevor, they never give numbers.
I know. God, it's worse than you, right?
It's unbelievable.
Really? Okay. What, have you guys put numbers out there?
Hey, you know, every once in a while.
Keeping our powder dry.
We'll have this conversation again in about a year.
Yeah. All right. Deal. All right. Senator Van Hollen, thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot. Good to be with you.
So, Rick, I mean, they're not going to win back the Senate, so, right?
You said it now, so there it is. Okay. We'll replay that sound when we need to.
If they win in Alabama, win in Nevada. Now, 50-50 is not winning. You got to win another seat because you had the vice president, Mike Pence, casting the tide. Where's the next pickup?
It's a brutal map. I mean, right now it's Nevada and Arizona are the top two. Number three on most lists is Texas. That tells you how slim pickings it is that they've got to beat Ted Cruz in Texas to pick that up. But look, if the Alabama thing gets some traction, and we've seen Democrats disappointed in the special elections for the House races. They've fallen short in all of those. It was a very disappointing special election year for them. They're hoping some momentum, though, maybe out of Alabama. That's really a long shot. Virginia governor changes it, but it's tough. Like you said, there's a reason Van Hollen's a freshman and he gets this big job.
Unbelievable. We have one more bit of sound coming back to the Graham Cassidy.
Yeah.
This last-ditch effort to try to, you know, for Republicans to repeal and replace before their magic reconciliation expires on September 30th. And our Ali Rogan, the ever-talented Ali Rogan, caught up with Susan Collins, who was quite instrumental in tanking the last two efforts to get this done. let's get a sense of where she is on this latest.
I have a lot of concerns about the bill. From the initial analysis that I've done, it would mean $1 billion less for the state of Maine. for Medicaid and other federal health care spending. We have a situation in Maine where if you take out our largest hospitals, the rest of the hospitals in aggregate lost $50 million last year. So you really jeopardize the very existence of those hospitals, particularly in rural Maine, but throughout our state. I'm also concerned that the bill does not afford automatic protections to people with pre-existing conditions. They would be sold insurance, but that insurance might well be unaffordable. So those are just two of the concerns that I have.
You know, it doesn't sound like a billion-dollar shortfall from Maine.
That sounds like a hard path to yes. You start there.
So you seem to think that Rand Paul's going to come around on this.
Listen, I do.
I mean, come on, man.
I think that right now. So let me just back up a second. This is a weird. This is deja vu. You mentioned deja vu again. Deja vu all over again. Susan Collins. This is time three for her. It's also time three for the CBO and essential health benefits and all of the, you know, the Heart Association, the Medical Association, the Doctor Association, AARP, they're all coming out against it. And it's, you know, Mike Pence is the closer all over again, and John McCain's going to be important all over again. And, oh, Jimmy Kimmel and the Jimmy Kimmel test, he's back railing against it. It seems like a replay, and you think, well, it's going to have the same conclusion. But there's a couple of different factors here. One is the September 30th deadline and the fallout from not getting this done and the idea that just getting something done is better than nothing. Second factor right now, to my mind, a very big one, is John McCain and his friendship with Lindsey Graham. Graham Cassidy, that means something. So, look, they were within a vote last time. Very famously, John McCain's thumb goes down instead of up, and that puts it in a position where it fails. I think if you have the exact same math as last time, even with Murkowski and Collins as a no, that leaves Rand Paul as the key person, as the guy that controls this. And will he want to say that he gave up on the last best shot to say that you repealed and replaced Obamacare? I find a hard time seeing that happen. We're already seeing President Trump turn up the Twitter heat on him. I feel like the pressure is going to intensify, including from outside groups, over the ensuing week. They're going to have the hearing. It feels like things are lined up for this to actually leave the station and pass the United States Senate.
Okay, so Rick Klein is predicting that A, it will pass, and B, that Rand Paul will be the 50th vote.
Yep.
So I will say I think that they can pull it over. I agree. I think it can pass. I'm not willing to go over 50% on that at this point. But I think that they can pull this off. But I will.
So you think that you think this?
Okay,
more
wait,
than
wait a minute.
Well,
can I please don't interrupt.
Okay,
please don't interrupt.
Yes, yes, yes.
But I think that the deciding vote will be Murkowski. That if she votes yes, it will pass. I do not believe Rand Paul will vote yes on this bill. If it comes down to Rand Paul, this will fail. So that's my prediction, Rick.
All right,
take that. Take that to the bank. Right.
Right,
and before we go, I just wanted to make sure our listeners know, because we didn't discuss this before, about your tremendous collapse in the fantasy baseball league this season, which was really, I mean, you had one of the best teams all during the regular season, and somehow you managed to choke when it came playoff time. And I don't know what happened to you, Rick, But anyway, I just want to say you were a great regular season.
I made the playoffs. I made the playoffs.
You were a great regular season team, and I just
did you make the playoffs? I can't remember what happened to you, if you guys, because you, what, how'd you do in the playoffs?
I think I just missed.
Yeah. Okay. It was just, it was. I'm
is
not
it possible?
Lie.
I think I actually might have had the actual worst record in the entire thing.
Something like that. Something like that.
Yeah.
Well, they say, you know, maybe next year.
Yeah, maybe next year. Maybe next year. Now we're focusing on the Nationals. All right, that is it for Powerhouse Politics. A special thanks to our team here, Dave Rind in New York, Avery Miller in Washington, D.C., and the legions and legions of supporters, especially Rick Klein's entourage. We thank all for making this podcast possible. Check us out on iTunes. Leave us a rating. Leave us a review. Do all of that stuff, and we'll catch you next week.